Welcome to the IMD Podcast Network. Today, IMD Dean of Faculty and Research, Stéphane Michel, sits down with Amar Bidet, Emeritus Professor at Tufts University and a founding member of the Center on Capitalism and Society at Columbia, drawing on insights from his latest book, Uncertainty and Enterprise, Venturing Beyond the Known. Amar unpacks the vital difference between risk and uncertainty, why this matters for entrepreneurs, and how imagination shapes decision-making in business and innovation.
My name is Stéphane Michel. I'm the Dean of Faculty and Research here at IMD. I have the pleasure to talk today with Amar Bidet, Professor at Columbia School of Public Health, Emeritus Professor and Thomas Schmidheiny Chair at Tufts University. Amar is a well-published author on entrepreneurship, which he taught for many years at Harvard Business School and Columbia University. Today, we talk about this book, Uncertainty and Enterprise, Venturing Beyond the Known. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Such a pleasure to be here in paradise, Lausanne.
Thank you. In your book, you make a distinction between risk and uncertainty, and it's very clear that this distinction is very important to you. So tell us what the distinction is and why it's so important to you.
The distinction was first made about 102 years ago by Frank Knight, and he distinguished between risks which are measurable, reliably measurable, because they can be mathematically calculated, or they can be derived from statistics, which he called basic standard risk, which we now can think of as statistical risk, and risks which are unmeasurable because they're one-offs, because the situation is unique, and therefore you cannot have a reliable objective probability distribution about what is likely to happen. And Knight's argument was you can only make profit under circumstances where the risks are not measurable. Because if they are measurable, then you can buy and sell that risk in the market, then you'll get the market rate of return. And in other circumstances, which are much more common than we imagine, sort of most of life involves unmeasurable risk. But it is only in those circumstances that we can expect to make a profit. I take that distinction much, much further. And I emphasize that not only is uncertainty, unmeasurable risk, critical to the realization of profit, it is fundamental to how humans collaborate. It is fundamental to how and why we speak to each other in natural language rather than math and statistics. And it's almost like the air we breathe, except we are not aware that we are breathing air, or a fish is not aware that the fish is in water.
And uncertainty, and this is thing that comes from your teaching and your experience and your research on entrepreneurship, I think this is really where it's especially important to understand the distinction when you are an entrepreneur.
It is vitally important to understand the distinction when you're an entrepreneur, particularly when you are investing in ventures, because I think most entrepreneurs themselves have an instinctive understanding of this, because they know what they're doing is unique in some way, shape, or form. I mean, even if it is another pizza store in another corner, it is that corner, it's that place, it's that time. And they are not bothered with what the probability distribution of the success rates of pizza stores or new businesses. They just look at the situation at hand and make a contextual judgment on whether that pizza store is going to be successful or not. They don't care about the probability distribution. It is frequently, however, people from the outside, people who are investing in them, who look at the entrepreneur as a draw from a distribution, and they say, aha, there's only a 1 in 10 chance that pizza store would be a success. That's irrelevant to the entrepreneur. That's irrelevant to the enterprise.
And so entrepreneurs deal much more with uncertainty than with risk. And what struck me, German being my mother tongue, in German we call venture capital, we call this risk capital. So then this is wrong on at least two sides, right?
Well, I think there's a distinction between how academics and particularly economists define risk and how normal people define risk. Normal people, basically, when you use the word risk, what they really think about is what is the likelihood of loss? How much could I lose? They're neither looking at probability distributions, nor are they looking at the uniqueness of the situation. Normal people are not misled by the distinction between uncertainty and risk. It is the academics whom you have to worry about. Nonetheless, even normal people can be, regardless of what word they use, normal people can sometimes misleadingly treat problems of where they do not know what is likely to happen as a draw from a distribution rather than a unique circumstance. So you can, to hire someone, you can say, I did a statistical model, I looked at such and such keywords on their resumes, and my model tells me that people who have such and such distribution on their keywords are good potential hires. And they are then implicitly treating what should be an uncertain question, which is who's the best candidate, to a statistical question. That is an increasing and dangerous feature of modern life, particularly in the era of artificial intelligence.
So I want to pick up on this because that's an invitation. Of course, we talk about distribution. We talk about a lot of data coming this together. We have now alien entity at the table who does this in great speed and also somehow has cracked the code of human language. So it interacts like a human. It's not human. It's an alien form of intelligence or not. So how much does this change? I think the changes on many different fronts, but how much does this change on your view of risk and uncertainty, but also on your view on entrepreneurship?
There's several interesting questions you asked in there. So first of all, speaking like a human is not the same thing as human speech. If you dig into how these models produce human speech, it is entirely through a statistical process. So they say, these two words, what is the most likely third word? And that may or may not have anything to do with your intent in the question that you're asking. But it produces such a lifelike replica of human speech that you think you are talking to an intelligent human person. And these things have been programmed to continue that pretense. I think this is extraordinarily dangerous because you ask this model a question. It is not actually understanding you. It is not understanding your question. It is taking the words you take, it's fitting them to a statistical model, and it is producing the best possible statistical answer to the question you asked. But it is producing that answer with such utter confidence that you believe that it is true. This drives me completely crazy. This drives me crazy when my students use these large language models to summarize what I ask them to read. The model does not summarize it accurately. This drives me crazy when I have written something and say, could you please simplify it or could you please shorten it? And yes, it simplifies and shortens, but it utterly loses the meaning. But again, the confidence with which the answer is produced makes you think, wow, I don't have to think anymore. These models are producing summaries of meetings. But who is actually going through checking to see whether the summary of the meeting is actually what was said in the meeting or the intent of the meeting? And so the vital human capacity to speak contextually, to use words that mean one thing in this context and mean another thing in another context, is being lost or at least being overridden. In certain circumstances, these models are fine. So if the past is exactly like the future, which is true in many medical instances. So in radiology, for example, you can, through a statistical model, do a pretty good job of diagnosing cancers. But not in business, where deliberately you want the future not to be like the past. And to believe it is extraordinarily dangerous, I think.
I have so many follow-up questions. Let's pick up the one when you mention an example from the medical field, because your research led from entrepreneurship much more into medical innovation. Why and how?
So first of all, I'd done all I found interesting in entrepreneurship. And I was, dare I say it, one of the pioneers in this field. I started studying entrepreneurship before it became fashionable. And then the swarm of people descended on this field. And they started analyzing entrepreneurship from a statistical point of view. And I thought they were losing the spirit of entrepreneurship. This is an ugly metaphor, but it was like a proctological exam of a beautiful person rather than looking at the beauty of the person itself. And equally at the time, I had been over the years interested in innovation. And I was under the impression that medical innovation was not as effective as it could be, or potentially ways in which it could be improved. But I didn't want to stay with this impression. I wanted to study it in the same kind of detail that I had studied entrepreneurs in the 90s and the 2000s. So I have done very detailed case histories of 15 transformative medical innovations. And there again, I find such similarities between what the innovator in an entrepreneurial in the medical field does and what an entrepreneur in business does. That yes, one is for commerce, one is not for commerce, but it's the same spirit, it's the same imagination. It's the same set of difficulties where you have an idea, you really strongly believe it, but you have to persuade other people that it's worth doing. And frequently, the idea that you start with is not something which works the way you thought it would work, and you have to modify it. And it's a rich and an exciting field. And again, here too, the idea that we are going to replace human imagination with AI to develop new treatments, I think is just fundamentally false.
So you brought back the point that I wanted to make. Thank you for that. And the terms of imagination, which again is very close to all your work, and you also said managing risk or mitigating risk has often to do with collecting more data. And AI is great with using a lot of data, but you are saying this, what we call in management, evidence-based decision-making, evidence-based management, comes at a high cost. Explain this to us who were taught that evidence-based management is the way to go in today's world.
I think evidence-based decision-making has utility in circumstances where you have utter confidence that the future is going to be exactly like the past. In other cases, as I say in my book, evidence is a complement to imagination. It is not a substitute for imagination. And this is true in every field. So a former governor of the Bank of England has very kindly cited this aphorism that evidence is a complement, not a substitute, in talking about inflation targeting. And he says the world, the economy as a whole, is a constantly evolving dynamic economy. And therefore, whatever model you had about how the economy worked yesterday is not the correct model for how the economy will work tomorrow. So you can fit any amount of data you want to your model of how the economy worked yesterday. To make a reasonable judgment about how the economy will work tomorrow, you have to use your imagination. Now, of course, this is not pure fantasy. Of course, all the data that you have used to think about your model in the past is what you will use in the future. But be aware that what you are, first of all, do not blindly extrapolate from what happened in the past, which would be pure evidence-based. But be aware that what you're doing is a blend. So consider a very simple spreadsheet. No, very few large businesses today will make a financial decision without using a spreadsheet model. Then you ask yourself, what is in the spreadsheet? So the spreadsheet may have thousands of cells. If you look within the thousands of cells, there will be 95% of them will be based on assumptions. And when you say it's based on an assumption, it means that you are exercising your imagination. And you're either exercising your imagination to believe that the future will be like the past in such and such way, or you're exercising your imagination to believe that the future will not be like the past and you have made these modifications to it. And it is this gestalt of imagination and facts which is in your spreadsheet about which you can have a discussion. And different people can look at the same spreadsheet and say, no, I don't believe in this assumption. I don't believe in that assumption. So it is not at all pure fantasy. So it's grounded imagination. It's imagination based on what has happened in the past, but it is with the realization that the future will not be like the past.
So this is shocking to me, because from now on, I will look at an Excel worksheet in a totally different way. It's a summary of my assumptions and then put into some numbers, and the numbers always seem very concrete and very real. And then I come up with all these formula. And I really like, and it shows your spirit and the importance of imagination that you researched in many different fields for so long. And yet you make a point about
the importance of reasonable routines. And reasonable routines we would consider as the opposite of imagination. So why should we probably rethink the importance of reasonable routines?
So first of all, you do not exercise imagination unilaterally unless you are simply a person who has enough wealth and all the resources that you need to proceed on your own. Or unless you are a dictator and you have such authority that you do not need to persuade anyone. In almost every other circumstance, the process of persuading other people or of combining imagination is through a dialogue, and it is through discourse. And a discourse in an organization needs to follow a certain set of protocols, regardless of which field you're in. So if you are in a criminal trial, to take an extreme example, yes? So there's a routine. So the witness gets sworn in, there's examination, there's cross-examination, this is what is allowed, this is what is not allowed, the judge is adjudicating what happens and what does not happen. And the whole process is established not to remove imagination, because you can never absolutely prove whether somebody did something, committed a crime or not, but to get the best possible, the most reasonable possible judgment about what happened and what did not happen. Likewise, in a large business, nobody has a complete picture of all the facts and all the imaginations. So you think this is going to be a fantastic product and you're an engineer. But then somebody comes in from the marketing side and says, no, the user interface is terrible and no reasonable user, unless she or he happens to be an engineer, will understand this. So therefore, you need a process by which this conversation takes place between the engineer and the marketer and the advertiser or the person who's actually producing the product and says, this is a fine technical design, but we will never be able to produce this at a reasonable cost. Now, you cannot put everybody into a room and say, just talk to each other. You will have chaos. And therefore, you need a procedure, a routine, if you will, through which these conversations can take place. Now, these routines can become pathological. They can become dysfunctional. And these routines can become ones where anybody has a veto over whatever gets done, where there's endless conversation, so nothing ever gets decided. Or you can have routines which are completely hierarchical, where it is simply the boss who decides and people's voices are never heard underneath. But good, reasonable routines are routines which allow for the individuality of the people who are involved in it. So these are not like Max Weber's routines, where Max Weber said, well, you have a bureaucrat, the bureaucrat has a certain set of rules, and in the ideal case, according to Max Weber, regardless of which person is sitting in that chair, you will end up with the same decision. In business or in most other fields, no. The person who is sitting in that chair, that person's imagination does matter, but so does the imagination of so many other people. So the idea of a routine is not to remove uncertainty or to remove imagination, but to align imaginations in a reasonable way. And again, I think one should distinguish between, let's say, the Six Sigma routines, which were extremely popular, which were to remove all defects in a process, with routines which are more forward-looking. And these are two quite different kinds of routines. And therefore, to try to use one routine for the other is a mistake. So if you do not want to use a routine that you use to plan or evaluate new ideas with a routine that you use to make sure that quality is absolutely perfect and a car is like a Mercedes, which has no defect in it. And somehow managers sort of, they recoil from the word routine. It's sort of what bureaucrats do. I am a leader. I'm a visionary. What do I need a routine for? No, this is not true. You absolutely do need a routine. Or at least you need a process. Call it what you will. But you do need something like that.
That's very interesting, because at IMD we have the privilege to work with leaders from very different also cultural backgrounds, and every person is different. And I think it's easy to see that some are, whether they read Max Weber or not, they tend to work more with routines, and they want to see, if I make this decision now, how does it fit into the whole? Or, do we establish a rule that we don't want? And some others would be much more have a tendency to be much more like one-off decision. And I think you mentioned this, that leaders need to be aware what's the differences between treating a decision as a one-off decision or a decision as part of a distribution. So what can leaders take away from that distinction?
Let me slightly amend what you just said, if I may. So there are routines. A decision can be a very large-scale routine or a large-stakes question. Or a routine can be a very small-stake decision. But both are one-offs. So to give you sort of an extreme example, if you are fighting a guerrilla war and you want to make a raid on a particular outpost in a particular place, you'd have a very small team and you would have a very fluid routine, which you do not plan too much. You leave a lot to discretion and a lot to judgment. And in the end, not very much can be go terribly wrong. But let us say on the other side, you're planning the invasion of Normandy at the end of the Second World War. It is still a one-off. The invasion of Normandy happened once in history. It will never happen again. But it is a very high-stakes enterprise. And it is also an enterprise which involves the army, the navy, the air force. It involves tens of thousands of soldiers. And therefore, you need a planning routine that is as good as it can be. Now, of course, there has to be some flexibility built into it. But the kind of routine that you would have for Normandy versus the kind of routine that you would have for a guerrilla war are very different. But the kind of routine that you would have for a statistical distribution is different from having something as a one-off. So, for example, let me take my example of banking. You can have a bank. One of the case studies I wrote was on Handelsbanken. And Handelsbanken is devoted to the idea that each borrower is unique. And therefore, each branch has absolute discretion in who it lends to and who does not lend to. Having said that, there is nonetheless a routine working in the background. So they do have to write a credit report. That credit report is examined by a credit bureau. So it's not without a routine. But on the other side, you can have a bank which says, we will lend against a model. And so we have a statistical model. We don't care if, say, 5% of our borrowers default, whereas Handelsbanken says we want 0% defaults. And the kind of routine that you will have in the second kind of bank will be a different kind of routine than you have from the first kind of bank. So in the second kind of bank, your routine will concern things like, how does our IT system work? How is the model calibrated? Is data properly entered into the system or not? So in both cases, routines, in the one case, it is mechanistically bureaucratic. In the other case, it is highly decentralized.
I think listening to you, what I see is that many big corporations, and you as a pioneer in the field of entrepreneurship, you know, you are part of this, that many big corporations want to become more entrepreneurial, right? I mean, we see the rise of entrepreneurship, I think, on two fronts. One is there's a lot of capital going into this, and a lot of the things that we use every day now were once startup. So startup is really fashionable in the last 40 years, a lot. And at the same time, a lot of big corporations often say, we want to break the bureaucracy, we want to become more entrepreneurial. Some do it better and some fail, and I think they fail through a particular pattern. When you see large companies want to break down bureaucracy and become more entrepreneurial, where do they fail and who succeeds?
So first of all, I think it is a fantasy that a large corporation can function like an individual entrepreneur. Large corporations have a raison d'etre. And the raison d'etre is to undertake projects of large scale and typically of large complexity, where the stakes are very high. And therefore, necessarily, when you have a large stake enterprise, you have to have a process that is much more tough, much stricter than in an entrepreneurial organization. One of the ironies, as I see it in studying entrepreneurship, is that as small businesses grow, they hire people from large companies precisely for the reason that they want to bring in the processes that large companies have. Because if they do not bring in these processes, the enterprise will fail. So if you have a small business, that's fine. Now you have a small IT department, you have a few people who run it. Soon you are, if you're successful, you want to have a cloud-based operation. If you want to have a cloud-based operation, you have need a much larger IT system. If you have a much larger IT system, there is necessarily a process by which... So Amazon is a great example. So Amazon started off by a very small, flexible, entrepreneurial venture. Today, Amazon is basically an IT company, or to a very large degree, an IT company. It has a huge organization which does IT. If you want to make a small change in any of the code, you need to get sign-offs at multiple levels and multiple users. And that you say, oh, this is bureaucratic. Can't we go back to the way Amazon used to be like? No, you can't, because if you introduce code which is incompatible, you will bring the whole system down. And I would bet, I have not been inside Tesla, I have not been inside SpaceX, I would bet that one of the reasons why Tesla's cars are so flawless, are so Mercedes class, is that they have to have routines to make sure that every part works with every other part and that there are no defects. The idea that SpaceX sends a rocket into space and it comes back in exactly the place where it comes back, that does not happen by accident. That does not happen by seat of the pants. You just have to come to terms as the founder of a big business, that the world will not be the way it used to be like. And to me, my favorite example is Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs was never at the cutting edge of technology, or almost rarely at the cutting edge of technology. Steve Jobs always waited to see until the technology and the components of the technology had evolved, where he had enough confidence that things could be put together in a way in which you could deliver value to the customer, which is a very different mindset from if you're a Silicon Valley entrepreneur with five people in a garage and you say, well, move fast and break things, which was the motto that Facebook used. And one of the great successes of Steve Jobs and of Apple is patience. Although what you see on the surface seems to look as if it is just sort of one visionary's imagination and so forth. But look at what Apple is doing with artificial intelligence. Everybody is sort of laughing at Apple because it has quote-unquote fallen behind its AI applications. But I think Apple is doing, in my view, the correct thing. It is waiting to see which use cases for artificial intelligence actually make sense for its product line, for its business, for its customers. And then it will move in with full force and full speed and deliver extreme value. So the notion that you will take a very large business and break it up into a small number of tiny businesses and each of them will do as they wish is a recipe for disaster, I think.
And since you mentioned Steve Jobs, it resonated with also what you say in your book, where we have this, you know, idea of an innovator or a startup as a hero. And you say, yeah, that's part of the story, but we should not only look at them as the hero, but also as someone who is very pragmatic. And I think this distinction is very important to you also as a teacher of startups and of entrepreneurs. So what is the hero and what is the doer?
So it's always nice to imagine the superhuman being who looks around corners, has X-ray vision, can jump in tall buildings in a single bound like Superman. So there are two aspects to this. First of all, this is a false image of how innovation progresses. Innovation, great advances are made in a very large number of small steps. And so humans did not become humans from a single-celled organism in one big leap. And so anything which looks like it just was an overnight success and the result of one person's doing is not true in practically any field that I can think of. So when people talk about artificial intelligence, well, artificial intelligence started about 60 years ago. And it has been progressing through trial and error, through a very large number of players who have moved it a little bit in this direction, a little bit in that direction. If you ask who is the hero of the World Wide Web, well, maybe you could say Timothy Berners-Lee. But it's not really Timothy Berners-Lee. It's just an army of people across a very large number of companies, large and small, most of whom are unknown, who have made the world happen. One of my classmates invented the spreadsheet. Nobody knows his name today. It is yet none Dan Bricklin, in case anybody's interested. Nobody remembers the name of his business. It was called VisiCalc. But the way we have come from VisiCalc in 1979 to Excel 2006, yes, there's a leading figure, there's a pioneer, but there is no hero of the story. And even if you look at a movie, and there are credits in the movie, and there's a star, there's George Clooney, but behind it, there are any number of cast members, their producers, their technicians, their editors, and it is this ensemble play. And this is absolutely true even in my medical innovation cases. So the person, there are two people who figured out that the treatment for ulcers were caused by bacterial infections. And that was a very good start. But to go from that discovery to 25 years later to actually have a treatment for ulcers were involved thousands of people. And they made mistakes, they were pragmatic, the initial antibiotics didn't work, so they had to try other things. So they were all hopeful people, but they were pragmatic. And so it was this combination of hope and pragmatism.
I really like that. And it goes back to what you said before, the importance of imagination on one thing, but also the dialogue that is vital importance. As we come to the end of this podcast, I want you to finish with reflecting. You wrote that book, and it's based on years and years of thinking about this, of many discussions you had. And so what is the most important takeaway for you as the author, as a teacher, as an educator, as someone who helps practice, out of this book? And maybe what is the surprise, what happened while you were writing the book and when you published the book? So what is your biggest takeaway and maybe the surprise as the author of the book, Uncertainty and Enterprise?
So I had always thought that narrative and storytelling at the back of my mind was important. I had never thought about it as carefully as I should have. And my classes, I now realize how important it is, how important human language with metaphor, with simile, with analogy is to the way humans progress. And that we should take this seriously but lightheartedly. And you cannot be dull, but you cannot reduce things just to numbers. I have friends who teach quantitative courses, and they go to the blackboard and they produce these numbers and they have derivations and they have equations. And I mean, I went through the same kind of education myself in my engineering degree. But now I realize the most important part of education and human interaction is our exchange in this human way through exchange of pictures, through exchange of similes, through the exchange of stories, and also how much remains to be done. And we're nowhere near the possibilities of human achievement.
I think that's a wonderful closing statement. I had the pleasure to also listen to you yesterday on your storytelling. And it's also a gift. I think we all aspire to be storytellers, and you have a special gift of doing that and of sharing that, and you are very generous of sharing that with us. So thank you very much on what I just saw yesterday as you sharing with us this experience.
And I'm happy to share that experience of teaching medical innovation to anybody who's interested.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Omar, for this wonderful talk.
It was entirely my pleasure. Thank you.
That's all for this week. This podcast was proudly brought to you by the International Institute for Management Development in Lausanne. You can find out more at imd.org.